Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jeffries, and I am your host for Bookend, presented by Quail Ridge Books, Raleigh, North Carolina's trusted community bookstore. My guest today is Ian Rankin, number one best-selling novelist, the recipient of an Edgar Award, a Gold Dagger for fiction, a Diamond Dagger for career excellence, and the Chandler Fulbright Award, amongst many others. His new novel is In a House of Lies, published by Little Brown and Company. Ian, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Ian, I entered my undergraduate studies at the University of South Carolina as a quote-unquote undecided major, which means that I had not yet declared a major. And then one summer, as I took summer classes in an attempt to graduate as quickly as possible, I took an English literature course with Dr. Thomas Rice. And in that class, we studied James Joyce. And as we sit here recording today, it's James Joyce's birthday. Happy birthday, James. Reading James Joyce and studying him unlocked something in my mind that I've never been able to lock back up. And I went home from this class one day and told my friend, Jody, I think I'm going to be an English major. And my friend was horrified. He threatened to do all kinds of unspeakable things to me if I majored in English, and yet I did it anyway. Researching you, Ian Rankin, and your history, it seems as if you had a slightly different but similar experience with your parents. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I grew up in a blue-collar town. It was not a town, a village, a few thousand people. That was mostly dedicated to coal mining, heavy industries. My parents had left school at 14, 15, served in World War II, got married, kids came along, they never owned their own house, they never owned a car. It was a poor family, but I was addicted to storytelling, you know, and to start with, it was comics, it was Batman and Superman, Spider-Man, all that kind of stuff. And as a kid, I was trying to write them because I was an obsessive kid, so it wasn't enough to read them. I wanted to write them as well. I would get little pieces of paper and fold them in half and make four-page booklets and break them up into squares and have little stick people in them and tell stories. And so, flash forward to when I was 17, 18, and I was going to do accountancy at university because there was an uncle in my family who was an accountant, and he did own his own car and he did own a house. My parents thought that would be a good thing for me to do. You know, it was one of these things where you go to college or university, if you're working class, if you're blue collar, to get a trade. But I had an epiphany. I was staying with my sister one day and my exam results had come in, and I hadn't done very well in economics and I'd done very well in English. I'd always done well in English. And I said to my parents, look, I'm sorry, but I'm going to go study English literature. And like you, went off to study people like James Joyce. Happy birthday, James. And eventually got funding for a PhD thesis on the works of Muriel Spark, whose birthday was yesterday, celebrating 101 years. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a famous Edinburgh novel called The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. And by that stage, I'd gone from wanting to write comic books to writing poetry, song lyrics, writing short stories. And as a PhD student with 3 years of funding, decided I would try and write some novels.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And now you're a number one best-selling novelist, an Edgar Award winner, Diamond Dagger Award winner, so many other things, as we mentioned earlier. And I want to talk to you, Ian, about your new novel, In a House of Lies. This novel opens in the woods, and there's a group of 11-year-old boys, and one of them is pushed down the side of a gully by his friend, and he stumbles upon a vehicle. Ian, what does he find in the vehicle?
He finds the skeletal remains of a private detective who went missing a decade before. And I got the idea for the novel. I was reading a news magazine, News and Satire magazine, which is called Private Eye, bizarrely enough. It's a UK publication. And they have occasionally mentioned this true-life case of a private detective in England who 30 years ago was investigating alleged links between senior police officers and organized crime, and he was found hacked to death in a pub car park. And nobody's ever gone on trial for it or ever gone to jail for it. And that just got the cogs turning in my head. And I got that scene straight away. This detective, private detective, went missing a decade ago. He was investigating some pretty dodgy stuff. Police never turned up a body, so he was always a missing persons case. Now, in the present day, the body comes to light. So we open a live murder inquiry, because it's fairly obvious the guy didn't commit suicide or die of natural causes. But as well as that, they're looking back at the original case, the missing persons case, to see if mistakes were made. And were the police officers involved in that guilty of corruption, collusion, or negligence? And it just so happens that my guy, Rebus, was part of that original inquiry. He's no longer a cop. He's retired. He's in his mid-60s. He's got some health problems. But here was a golden opportunity for me to bring him back into a book.
Great. And because we mentioned James Joyce earlier, the private detective that was discovered in the car, his name is Stuart Bloom. any allusion to Leopold Bloom there? Is it just a good name?
You know, there's obviously an allusion to Leopold Bloom there. Yeah, I mean, I taught, when I was a postgraduate student, I taught Ulysses to 18, 19-year-olds who were doing their undergraduate degree, and the bafflement on their faces as we tried to explore this book together was something to behold. But yeah, Bloom's an extraordinary character, and when I finished at university, the first thing I did was go to Europe with my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, and she had worked at Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris for a short time when she was a teenager. So we went back there and we stayed at Shakespeare and Company, and of course Shakespeare and Company was the original publisher of James Joyce's Ulysses. And although it's not on the same site as the original shop, it was still an exciting thing to live there for a week or two, work in the store at night, and then you got a free bed, and that was what you got paid, was a bed for the night. And yeah, so I guess that's where Bloom comes from. Where do all these things come from? I do like character names. I save them up. I collect them.
Great. Thanks, Ian. I want to ask you about technology. I feel like I could write a whole graduate thesis on the subject of technology in this novel, In a House of Lies. The boys in the novel's first scene are all snapping pictures of the car and the corpse with their smartphones. There are countless allusions to laptops in a joking manner, FaceTime, Facebook, WhatsApp, jokes about cars that don't have USB portals, the cloud, e-cigarettes, and the list goes on and on. Can you talk a little bit about technology in this novel?
Well, my guy Rebus, I mean, when we first saw him, it was 1987 and he was 40 years old. And there wasn't much technology around at that time. Police stations didn't have many computers. They may have one computer on the premises. Nobody had cell phones. The fax machine was a new god that sat in the office. And if a fax arrived, it must be really important. And, you know, as I've been writing the series, technology has been changing at such an extraordinary pace. And so I've got to keep on top of it because the police use it. They use social media. Say a missing persons case, they would use social media. If a teenager gets in trouble or goes missing or is killed, then, of course, they're looking at their the websites they used to use and looking at all their friends they've got online to try and get information, find out what happened to them. In the UK, we've got a lot of CCTV. I think someone told me there's more CCTV cameras in London than there are in the whole of the US. That was certainly true a few years ago. So all this technology you've got to keep on top of because the police certainly use it. Pathologists and forensics people, senior crime officers will be using this technology. But my guy Rebus is a bit like me. He's a Luddite. He's very old-fashioned. He doesn't understand it. He finds it bewildering the way the world is turning. He owns a smartphone, but he can use very little of it. He certainly has no truck with things like Facebook and Twitter. And I'm not on Facebook. You know, I'm a 58-year-old man. I'm not on Facebook. But I do use Twitter quite a lot. I find that quite fun. So I like, you know, trying to... There's a little bit of humour. There's potential for humour in Rebus's bewilderment with new technology. But also it shows the way policing has changed. It's just part and parcel of the way our world has changed. And also the way that crime has changed. A lot of crimes exist now that couldn't exist when I started this series. Online stalking, cybercrime, people stealing your identity, people getting to your bank account via the internet banking, people seamlessly sending billions upon billions of dollars and pounds around the world without anybody knowing they're doing it, because it's all done with the press of a button. And it goes into these really strange, dark places where nobody knows they've got these people are shifting this money around. So drug people can shift money around the world. Oligarchs and tyrants can burrow away and hide lots of money from the world and from the Internal Revenue Services and everybody else. So all of that is fascinating to the crime writer. And I think it's, you know, it is changing the nature of crime. It's changing the kinds of crime the police deal with. But also it's changing the way they deal with those crimes.
All right, thank you. Sometimes the old ways are the best indeed. Ian, we're going to pause for a moment for a word from our sponsor, and then we will be right back with Ian Rankin. The Bookin Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there, you know the name, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', B-O-O-K-I-N, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I am speaking with Ian Rankin, author most recently of In a House of Lies, published by Little Brown and Company. Ian, I've spent some time in Edinburgh at the university there near Arthur's Seat, and I'm picturing the university and then Arthur's Seat and then the castle. It was a really peaceful place, actually, to spend a few days in what was a fairly lengthy journey throughout Europe. What are the noticeable differences between a detective novel that takes place in Scotland versus a detective novel that takes place in, let's say, Los Angeles or New York?
Well, I guess the most obvious difference would be the lack of guns. I mean, Raymond Chandler famously said, if a scene isn't working, just have a man walking with a gun. You can do that in the States because there's a lot of guns out there, but it's not so easy in the UK. I did an event a couple of years ago in a bookstore, not here, but on the other side of the country. And I said, look, I've seen guns in shop windows, but I've never held one. And this old guy came up to me afterwards, a fan, and he said, Do you want to? He was carrying a piece in a bookstore in one of the safest, whitest places in America. And so the owner said, take it out to the sidewalk, went outside, and he popped a clip from his pistol and he handed it over. And he said, do you want to pull the trigger? And I said, no, I do not want to pull the trigger. I'm not very happy. I feel very... So that's the thing. We don't have that. I think that's a huge difference. But at heart, whether you're a mystery writer working in the States or working in any other country, working in the UK, you're dealing with big moral issues, you're dealing with society and the problems we have in society, you're dealing with ordinary people put into extraordinary situations, you're making the reader ask what they would do in these situations. You're asking a very basic question of your readers, which is why do we human beings keep doing terrible things to each other? That's what all crime fiction is predicated upon. So at heart, you get all of that. And what the differences then are cultural. So if I want to find out about any country, any city, any culture in the world, I go straight to the mystery novels because they are replete with cultural references, with history, with geography, places to avoid, places to go and eat, places to go and drink, you know. People come to Edinburgh now, they go straight to the Oxford Bar. It's a real bar where I drink and where Inspector Rebus drinks. Of course, they are horribly disappointed to find he's not there and they've only got me, this quiet, shy, liberal guy. Not dark, not dangerous, not complex, not conflicted. But I like that. I like using the real city as much as possible in the books. And yeah, you're right. You know, you've been to Edinburgh. Not a huge crime wave going on. And I often say to people, my books represent the potential for these things to happen. So these crimes may not have happened, they may never happen, but the potential for them exists.
Thanks. Earlier, you alluded a little bit to reading comics when you grew up, and I want to talk about graphic novels and B-movies a little bit. At the North Carolina Book Festival, which is coming up at the end of this month, February, we have a great panel conversation featuring B writer Rockton McKinney and some folks that work on the excellent North Carolina Comic Con. You, Ian Rankin, wrote a graphic novel, Dark Entries, that starred John Constantine of Hellblazer fame. And your new novel, In a House of Lies, features two B-movies, the wonderfully titled Zombies versus Bravehearts, and then towards the end, Cops versus Demons. Have you thought about writing a graphic novel version of either of these films?
Oh, man, what a great question. I haven't thought about it. It sounds pretty appetizing to me. It sounds pretty appealing. When I did that original comic for Vertigo, what happened was, Vertigo DC, what happened was they'd seen all these interviews that I'd done where I'd talked about comics, and I still read them, I still buy them, and I enjoy them, and I hang out as much as possible with comics people. And they said, have you ever thought about writing a comic? And I said, you're 40 years too late. I would have killed for that when I was a teenager, you know? They said, well, you know, if you get any ideas, come back to us. And I love Constantine Hellblazer. He's a PI and of the old school, but he just happens to deal with demons and the undead and everything else. So I thought, well, I'll give that a go, and did this 200-page standalone graphic novel that's part of the Constantine universe. And they said, if you get any more ideas, come back to us. But I've been pretty busy. There's a comic in the UK called 2000 AD, which I used to read when I was a teenager, and it's still going 30-odd years on. And 40 years on, oh my God. And they've asked me if I fancied doing Judge Dredd, who's one of their recurring characters, and I would. He's a kind of lawman in a future America, kind of like RoboCop but in human form. It's been filmed a couple of times, and when I get back home from this tour, I'm going to start thinking if I can come up with any fresh ideas for what to do with Judge Dredd. I love the form. I love graphic storytelling, and if I could have drawn, if I had any ability, any skill at all in drawing, that's what I would have done as a young man. You know, I'm a mystery novelist because I failed at everything else. I failed to be a rock star. I failed at poetry. I failed at trying to write film scripts. B-movie film scripts, man, what about that? Bravehearts. Yeah, I mean, you know, now with Outlander, everybody's kind of looking at the Scotland of the past, and maybe there is room for that kind of crossover. We have no movie industry, though, in Scotland at the moment, and so getting films made is a tough, tough old business. But if a producer is out there listening, get in touch.
Please do, and we will look for that. Ian, you just mentioned being a failed rock star, and I know you are a musician, and music's important to the characters of your novel. Van Morrison and Brian Eno pop out in particular, both of which are alluded to in your new book. Is it important to you to place music into your novels?
Various reasons for me doing that. I mean, number one, every mystery writer I know is a frustrated rock star. We'd much rather be rock stars than writers, but we failed early on. I was in a punk band when I was 19. We weren't very good, and we didn't go very far. I got back into a band just recently of kind of men in their 50s who should know better, and we just get together and jam. But I'm back writing lyrics again and vocalising, I would say singing, but that would be putting that a bit strongly. That's my role in the band. But because I'm a failed rock star, I thought I'm going to put as much music in the books as I possibly can. And also, I think it delineates character. If you're new to the Rebus books, when you first meet him and you see him sitting late at night with a glass of malt whiskey in his room, listening to vinyl, listening to the Stones or Van Morrison or Leonard Cohen or whatever he happens to listen to, Rory Gallagher, you will start to get a sense of this guy's personality. His age, is he blue collar, or, you know, did he grow up working class, whatever. You'll get that from the fact he prefers the Stones to the Beatles maybe and listens to Rory Gallagher. He's a bit of a loner. He's not listening to dance music or anything that would get you up and moving. He's sitting there introspectively. In this book, he listens to Brian Eno and ambient music because his girlfriend is trying to persuade him that he needs to relax and he should be getting into mindfulness. I've got to say that experiment is not going very well, and I think it won't be too long before Rebus is back listening to blue-collar rock again. But I listen to Eno a lot when I'm writing. I listen to ambient music a lot. I've always got music on when I'm writing. And because there's so much music in the books, musicians have become fans of the books, and I've got to hang out with the Stones, I've got to work with Van Morrison. I did an album with a Scots musician called Jackie Levin, who was a big fan of the books. I didn't know that when I had Rebus be a fan of his music. And we ended up making an album together and touring together, and sadly Jackie's no longer with us. But yeah, it's been fantastic. It's got me as close to being a rock star as possible because I get to hang out with them.
Thank you so much, Ian. Would you like to read us a short passage from your novel?
Sure, I will. And I'll do it, from the beginning, because with mystery novels, once you get a little bit in, you're having to explain everything that just happened. So here we go from the very beginning. The car was found because Ginger was jealous of his friend Jimmy. There were four of them in the woods that morning. It was the February breaks. No school for a few days. They'd taken her bikes as far as they could and left them when the path became overgrown with roots and fallen branches, suddenly forming a makeshift assault course. All four of them were 11 years old in the same class, Ginger, Alan, Rick and Jimmy. Jimmy's bike was the most expensive. His stuff always was, clothes, backpack, bike. His parents always bought the best. His bedroom was stuffed with games, consoles and the latest releases, which was why Ginger waited till Jimmy was standing at the very edge of the deep gully, sweating and panting after all that running and jumping they'd been doing, before giving him a shove. There wasn't much force to it. Ginger had intended Jimmy would get a fright, maybe slide a few feet down the slope, but be able to claw his way back without help, while the rest of them laughed and watched and filmed. But the sides were steep and unstable, and Jimmy tumbled and skidded all the way down, falling into the mass of bracken, briar and nettles at the bottom. "I didn't do it," Ginger said, this being his default position.
Thank you. That's a great introduction, and this is a great novel. I have been speaking with Ian Rankin, author of In a House of Lies, published by Little Brown and Company. Ian, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thank you.
Once again, I would like to thank Ian Rankin for joining me. Signed copies of In a House of Lies can be purchased in-store or online at www.quailridgebooks.com. Our sponsor is Libro.fm Audiobooks. Head on over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's B-O-O-K-I-N, to get 3 months for the price of one and support our podcast in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been Bookin'.